Well, summer is in full gear, and that means our insect world is in full gear as well. So we thought it'd be a good time for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world and entomology, with Dr. Beverly Burden, our Associate Professor of Biology at LSUS, and our resident entomologist here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, thanks for stopping by today.
Oh, Bill, it's my pleasure. I live for these opportunities to educate the public on what's going on in the insect world and to know what their concerns are, so perhaps I can help them a little bit as well. It's all about the education.
All right. Well, let's get started tonight with a question about baseball. So, for baseball fans out there, most of you know that many of our baseball bats are actually made of wood, and the wood that they use is the ash tree. Now, there are other woods that are used as well, but ash seems to be the most popular wood for baseball bats. Right now, in the Northeast, these trees are being attacked by a new insect. Can you fill us in on exactly what's going on with this new bug?
I can, Bill. It's not native to the United States. It comes to us from Asia and Eastern Russia. The common name for this insect is called the emerald ash borer. It's called emerald because it has this beautiful metallic green coloration, especially on its back, and it lays its eggs on ash trees, and the grubs of the beetles, if they are a beetle, will burrow into what we call the vascular system. That's basically the circulatory system of a tree that brings the water from the roots up to the leaves. The leaves make the sugar and the nutrients, and the leaves send the sugar and the nutrients back throughout the tree to be distributed. And these wood borer beetles are destroying the circulatory system of these trees. And initial infestation rates may just look like a part of the tree is dying, but once it gets to that part, it's pretty much a goner. It is all the way up through most of the New England states, most of the Mid-Atlantic states. As far south as it's come so far is as south as Tennessee, Missouri, and Kansas. And so we know the eastern forest of Oklahoma, the forest of Arkansas. I was at the tail end of a Southwestern insect forests conference down in New Orleans a couple weeks ago, and I talked to one of the key authorities, Dr. Lynn Risky-Kinney, who said if you have ash trees in your state, it's not a matter of if they're coming, it's only a matter of when they're actually going to get there. And right now, we don't have a lot of great tools to do this tree. Most of the time it's like the southern pine beetle where you can just do sanitation. If you see an area that's infested, go out and cut it all out just like you would clean out a wound, cut out all the infection, haul it away. It's not always a good idea to burn it because that will cause dispersal of the adults. And it is going to make a major impact on a lot of the manufacturing aspects of the ash tree, like our Major League Baseball bats. And, of course, this causes all of the Major League pitchers to shiver that they may have to go to aluminum bats, and that's going to throw all the statistics right out the window.
There you go. Give us a call right now with your question about insects and our insect world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Now, before we went online, we had a picture that was sent to us, and it was a particularly gruesome-looking spider, long legs, fairly colorful midsection and abdomen, and we weren't really sure what that was, and we are going to post this photograph on our webpage a little later on after we post the podcast audio for this program. So folks who are listening right now, obviously you can't see it right now, but you'll be able to get a glimpse of it later. Can you tell us what kind of spider that is?
Well, first let me give them a description. Most of the time when you want to take a picture of a spider, always like use a dime or a quarter or some type of a reference. And that would have been helpful here, but I've seen this spider before. Its abdomen is about the size of a regular dime. It has extremely long legs, especially the front pair of legs, and oftentimes it has very decorative patterns both on the back of the spider and on the underbelly of the spider, what we call the ventral surface. And these belong to the orb weavers, which is a very, very large family of insects. And these are the ones that are very active this time of the year because the females are trying to build their nest at night, take in as many, they're carnivores, taking as many insect meals or other spider meals, moths, that they can get in order to increase their protein content so that they can lay eggs that will overwinter. And one of the unique things in industrialist aspects that I like about these orb weavers is that they'll build a brand new nest every night, tear it down in the morning, digest their meals during the day, come back out. If the catching was good, they'll go to the same place, build their brand new nest again. And oftentimes they'll have very thick, zigzaggy, thick white lines to the web. And oftentimes these are what in the insect and arachnid world we call the ones that build arachnoleptic nest, because once you walk into them you throw a fit because you think you're automatically going to be bit by a deadly spider and die. But these are very non-aggressive and they're a wonderful part of the urban ecosystem. So I would just, unless they're really causing a problem with the grandkids or the kids, just let them do their thing and be a part of your natural backyard ecosystem.
Or you could be like me and just get the willies around spiders. So I was in a swampland once taking some photographs and turned around and walked smack dab into a banana spider web with the banana spider literally about an inch from
huge.
My nose. Yeah. And I lost my boots in the swamp because my feet came up out of the boots as I was getting out of the muck.
I think it's just, a startling factor rather than a fear factor, that the insects are going to harm you or the spiders are going to harm you. Most spiders around here, unless it's the brown recluse or the black widow, their bites are going to be less than or equal to the sting of a wasp.
Well, give us a call right now with your insect questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're taking your calls tonight here at Red River Radio on the program What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden. She is an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. Now, the other thing going on right now, of course, all across the country, you're hearing stories about a bug that we all know about. It's the cicada. But as we had talked before the show, there are many different varieties, like there are of many insects, of cicadas. Can you give us a lowdown a little bit quickly? We do have Rick online. Rick, hang on here for a second. We'll get to you in a minute. But can you give us a quick lowdown about the cicadas and what we can expect here in Louisiana?
My 2 cents may turn into a dime's worth, but the ones that we have here in the Arklatex that emerge every year are called annual cicadas because they come out every year. They're an annual species, but there are something that we call periodic broods, and these are the ones in which the immatures can live underground for 17 years. There's actually 12 different geographical broods, and we number them by the Roman numerals. There are 12 of these that are underground for 17 years. They emerge, and then they go back underground for another 17 years. Now, right now, brood 2 of a 17-year periodic cicada is emerging right now along the Iowa Illinois border there. The brood 3 of 13-year cicada, so these come out every 13 years, is supposed to come out next year, and this is I'm sorry, it's the brood 12 of the 13-year periodical cicada that will come out next year between Louisiana and Mississippi in year 2014. But they're only going to be found along the Mississippi Valley, so you would have to travel over to the basically the Vicksburg area would be the closest shot from here. Now, the closest to the Arklatex area and to the whole Red River Radio listening to community, depending on which transmitter, is going to come out in 2015. And this is a 17-year brood, so they come out every 17 years. And the Roman numeral is 4. They'll come out in 2015. And the last emergence of these was in 1998, and I have some of those specimens. They tend to be a little bit smaller. They'll have red eyes. And so we have a lot of cicada. And just for one of my pet peeves, and we'll get to the caller in just a moment, is that here in our colloquial language, we call cicadas or locusts. Is what we call them, and those we say if we hear them up above the trees, those are the locusts. But in fact, throughout the rest of the United States, they're called cicadas because in ancient writings, in biblical writings, when they were saying that people would go out and gather locusts and honey, they weren't talking about the things that crawl in the tree. Locust, by definition, is a large, juicy, high in protein, low in cholesterol grasshopper. And of course, they would eat the honey and the big, nice, juicy grasshoppers. And so that's the difference between cicada locusts, between annual cicadas and periodic cicadas.
All right. Well, we have our first caller online. We're going to go, and just so you know, those listening, Cal, you're up next, and Jim, you'll be after that. But Rick from Bossier right now online. Rick, what is your question on what's bugging you?
Well, okay, I've always wondered what's the purpose of a wasp? Like, I know bees do pollination and then ants help with decomposition, but I don't understand the purpose of a wasp. They suck. They tick me off, you know.
Well, there's a lot of different types of wasps, and one thing, Rick, is that you have the colonial wasp that will build the paper nets or the paper nets that they will put underneath the eaves and the dormers of houses, and those are the ones that torment you. There are also wasps that live underground, and they're predators. Wasps are all predators. And the one thing that we like to make sure that we get across in educational value for entomology is that wasps do not bite, and it's only the female wasp that will sting, because the stinger is actually in a modified egg-laying organ. And then we have the hornets around here, and we got quite a bit of information about a month ago with the cicada killer hornets that were around town. They do take cicadas and they bury them underground and they lay eggs on them, and they're basically are supplying nurseries for their young. So they're keeping, you know, the locusts in check. And then we have the mud dauber wasp, which is also one of my favorites, and they'll build their little mud dauber nest. And if you take a little bit of hammer or screwdriver and break one of those open, be careful, do not stand directly underneath it, because they provision them with living spiders, and so their young actually eat the living spiders alive. Mm-hmm. Which Hollywood can't make up stuff better than that, Bill. You know, that's it. You know, it's just great. So they're predators, and they are part of the natural ecosystem to keep everything in check.
You are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program on bugs and entomology with Dr. Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist here. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. Again, that is 800-552-8502. Cal from Winsboro, Texas, you are online. What's bugging you tonight?
Oh, very good. I love your show. I was just up in my garden picking black-eyed peas, and there were just many different kinds of insects buzzing around. Looked like they were probably getting aphids off of them and pollinating them and so on. I got to wondering how I could identify those. Do you have any favorite websites that I could use to try to do that?
There is a website called Watch This Bug. My favorite website is beverly.burden@lsus.edu, where you can take a photo and send it to me. And not only can I have that photo in my archive accredited to you as the photographer, but then I can be in direct communication with you. And if my website isn't online, I'll ask our web manager, Wally Derleth, to put it on there so people can email me and send me pictures. And here's some rule of thumbs. If it's a caterpillar worm thing, it's normally eating the foliage. If it's buzzing around and kind of hairy, then it's a pollinator. If it's buzzing around and not hairy, then it's probably a predator on the pollinators or on the caterpillars that's eating it. Always look, not on the top of the leaves, but always look on the bottom of the leaves, because that's where the aphids and the whiteflies, the ones that are the vampires of the insect world, that are going to be sucking all the sugar juices and the water nutrients out of the plant. And if that's the case, then all you need to do is make yourself up a little simple, very dilute water soap solution, spray it on the underneath the leaves, and that should take care of those soft-bodied aphids. And of course, most people can recognize lady beetles, and they're the good guys, yeah, as always. And if we have time later, I can tell you why they're called lady beetles. It's kind of a cute story. Did that answer your question, Cal?
Well, we've moved him on. So we hope that answered your question. And by the way, both for this show and for our Bird Calls show, if you see something and you'd like to get it identified, do send us a photograph, and we'll go ahead and do that online, and then we'll post that photo on our webpage as well, and give you credit, of course. So just you can send it to Dr. Burden for the bugs, or you can send any photograph of any birds to me at wbeckett@lsus.edu, and that's how we're going to be able to help folks identify more things, because a photograph, a picture is worth a thousand words, literally.
Absolutely. So
we're going to go next. First, I'm going to give out the numbers, 800-552-8502. You can call us in with your questions about insects and anything entomological. And we're going to go next to Jim from Keithville. Jim, what's bugging you tonight?
Dr. Burton, out here in Keithville in the spring, we saw a black-bodied critter in our gardens with orange stripes. I looked it up, and it said something about a lubber, but I thought those were back east. Well, anyway, now that was when they were younger. Now I think they've morphed into huge grasshoppers. I mean, these things are really big, 3, 4, 5 inches long. But they don't seem to get out of the way. In fact, they kind of stare you down when you see them. I just wondered what they eat and what we do to get rid of them if they're a danger to the foliage.
Jen, that's a great question, because it allows me to address actually two different things at once. The development of insects basically come into two forms: direct development and indirect development. If you see something that looks like a baby grasshopper and it grows up to be a grasshopper, then that's going to be direct development. But if you look at something like a fly, where it starts off as a maggot, or a caterpillar, where it starts off at a caterpillar and then maggots turn into flies and caterpillars turn into beautiful butterflies, that's indirect development. And so the thing with direct development, where the immatures look similar to the adults, the main difference is going to be the formation of the wings. And so when the lubber grasshoppers are very young, they have these very noticeable red, black, and oftentimes yellow stripes on the abdomen, because the wings have not yet grown to cover them out. And then as they do grow, they grow in size, they molt larger, they are foliage feeders, so they're feeding on leaves, seeds. And if they're not doing appreciable damage, if you're not seeing any noticeable yield loss in your fruits and vegetables, I would just let them go. They're so big, you can just knock them down and stomp on them if you want to, instead of using an insecticide. But if you do want to use an insecticide, I would suggest that you use a nice carbaryl dust. Sometimes it goes underneath the trade name of 7, or you can use almost any type of pyrethroid, and that's another thing that I love to teach people when I come on the show. You should always look at the active ingredient on an insect label, and if it ends in THRIN, then that's called a pyrethrin, and it's normally a good knockdown for 85% of the insects. But if that doesn't work, then don't go back and get another insecticide that ends in THRIN, because it's not going to work either. Go back to a carbaryl or some other type of active ingredient. Like I said, only you can be the judge on what level of pestilence they occur, and they are very common around here. You said they only occur in the east. The thing is that you don't see them everywhere, but where you do see them, they are abundant.
You are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program about insects and the bug world, and with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, who is an associate professor of biology at LSUS. You can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with your question or concern about anything dealing with our insect world. Coming up, we have Don from Stevens, but right now we're going to go to Bill from Nacogdoches. Bill, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi. Well, I don't know what you call them, but they're about 1 inch long, and maybe they are something like in the centipede family or something, but they're crunchy, and if you touch them or kick them or something like that, they roll up in a little ball. So I have a lot of them that seem to be all around in the front yard, and sometimes after it rains, they just kind of take over. I'm wondering what they are and if there's anything I can do to decrease the population.
Well, what you're describing are millipedes. Most of the time when people hear you say that they'll roll up into a little ball, they're normally thinking of the roly-polies. Those are actually crustaceans. In fact, they're one of the few terrestrial crustaceans that exist. But what you're describing are millipedes, and sometimes these are confused with centipedes. And let me tell you the difference. Millipedes are round, and they do not have fangs, and they have two pairs of legs per segment, whereas centipedes are flat. They do have fangs, and they have only one pair of legs per segment. And one would think that, well, that means that you can mess around with millipedes, but not centipedes, because centipedes have fangs. I wouldn't suggest holding or picking millipedes up, because although they don't have fangs, they will release a very smelly substance on your hands that, according to ornithologists, the bird people, it leaves a very bitter taste in their mouth. And they're absolutely harmless. They're not eating your plants. If you want to, sweep them up and put them in the garbage. But they're actually an integral part of the ecosystem in the fact that they are breaking down organic matter. They're taking leaves, they're taking pine leaves, they're taking roots, and they are returning it back into organic matter that contains nitrous, phosphorus, and potassium that the roots can then use and the plants can then use as natural fertilizer and compost.
All right. We have a couple of callers online. You are listening to What's Bugging You. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have Daryl and Wade on hold, but right now we're going to go to Don from Stevens, Arkansas. Don, what's bugging you?
Well, I tell you what. I'm interested in catalpa worms, and there seems to be no consistency with regard to one year you see them, one year you don't. And so I'm wondering if they're a generic and specific to a particular catalpa tree, or can you give me a little insight on how we can increase our fantastic fishing bait?
I was going to say, you must be an angler, because catalpa worms are prized fishing bait. There are some insects, and catalpa worms are like this, that will go into annual cycles. And this has a lot to do with the predators that they prey on. One year, the catalpa worm population will increase, so their predator will increase, and knock down the catalpa worms so the next year they don't build up so much. And so that year there's not so many predators, so the catalpa populations build up again. And it's just a natural cycle. And you can see this in any predator-prey relationship, whether it's foxes and hares or wasps that feed on catalpa worms. As far as catalpa tree species, there's not a lot of diversity as far as I know. I wish my friend Kilpatrick was here. He would know more about the diversity of catalpa tree species. But I will also tell you that you can keep catalpa worms alive on different leaves other than catalpa plants if you do catch them until they get to be nice, big, juicy fish bait. And Don, I can also tell you this. If you find out the secret of manufacturing and growing a steady supply of catalpa worms, I would like to buy stock, because that's going to be a great economic entrepreneurship endeavor.
Maybe they like kudzu.
I doubt they like kudzu, but nevertheless.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program about the insect world with resident entomologist Dr. Beverly Burden. She's an associate professor here at LSUS. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Daryl, Wade, and Bill online. Daryl, you're up next on What's Bugging You. What's bugging you tonight?
How you doing? I have a problem with fleas this year. Unreal. We haven't had a lot of rain, and I have used just about everything I know to get rid of these fleas, especially these giant sand fleas, and I just can't get rid of them.
What type of habitat are we talking about when you're talking about the sand fleas? Are you talking about along a beach line?
No, it's in my yard, because I got places where the grass isn't grown, and I got a dirt driveway coming up, and there's some sand in the yard. But when the kids go outside and play, they just come in and just ate up with fleas, and I have sprayed the yard. I put granules out. I've tried so many different things, and I just can't seem to get rid of these big fleas.
How many dogs and cats do you have?
I have one dog, and that's it.
Must be a big one.
Yes, it is.
I'll tell you an old tale that I've heard, and I've actually, have seen it in action, but you have to be very careful. A lot of people that have rent houses that will have renters that will move out and leave a large resident flea population will treat the entire rent house with rock salt. Rock salt tends to dehydrate the insects, and it decreases their moisture availability. And moisture availability for insects is a huge aspect for their positive development and growth. But if you're trying to establish a lawn, if you're trying to establish other vegetative growth, then the rock salt would probably be more toxic to the plant growth than it would be the insect growth. I would keep the yard mowed down. Sanitation is going to be your best bet. Get your weed whacker out and just make it as least hospitable as possible. If you want to spray that area with a little bit of mild salt water, it probably wouldn't hurt the vegetation that much. And just keep the children out of there, because even though fleas can live a long time without a blood male, those females are looking for a blood male, and they won't take another one until they lay another batch of eggs. And so just sanitation, especially on the outside, I've never heard of a bad of a problem as that, because the immatures of fleas are not actually feeding on blood. They're feeding on just dried, decayed, a lot of time fecal matter left over from the animals, but it doesn't seem like that'll be a project. That's, you got me on that one almost, but try that and see how it works.
Sure. Thank you very much.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You, our program on entomology with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And we are going to go to Wade next in Alexandria. Wade, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I hate to say it, but I'm about to basically almost replicate what the other fellow just said. Same problem, huge problem with fleas. Now, I have a little bit of a difference. I have a few more animals. I have two indoor pets and a couple that can, that are allowed to go back and forth. But and I usually keep the higher dollar flea medications on them, frontline, advantage, whatever. But it seems I can't. It's like it's of no use anymore.
Yeah.
I don't really see the fleas in the yard, but they get into the carpet, and I've treated them with, like you said, the periphery, and multiple vacuuming, periphery again, get them up. It seems like I can knock it down a little bit in the house, but no matter how much I put the medicine on the animals, more things seem to be eat up with it, and it must be in the yard. I have a combination of it.
Okay, Daryl, you're breaking up pretty bad on us, so we're going to let Beverly try to answer that question.
Yeah, I think I got enough. And one thing that I did not mention to Daryl that I should have, and that is to go ahead and spray the area with a general type of a pyrethrin. That is going to help sometime, and that's not going to be toxic to the plants. Since you have an inside problem as well, there is a flea powder. It's a pyrethrin that you can put down on the carpet, let it stay on the carpet for a while, and vacuum it up. And here's the key thing. Once you vacuum, you take that vacuum bag out, you seal it in a garbage bag, and you throw it away because they can't crawl right back out of there. So vacuum, vacuum, vacuum the house, vacuum where the pets are sleeping, and then out in the yard, keep on a weekly to a bi-weekly pyrethrin. And once the temperatures start dropping, then that's going to ease off. If you've been dealing with it all summer, I would say you're almost at the end of it anyway. And it always brings me to the next thing that I like to share with people, with both Daryl and Wade. People ask me, Beverly, when are the insects going to take over the world? They already have.
Yeah.
And they're just barely allowing us to exist here with this unfortunate. They're going to cause a certain degree of pestilence.
They certainly outnumber us multitudes. So we have two online follow-up questions to the earlier conversation about wasps. One of those was, what type of red wasp resides around metal fencing and poles? And the second question is, do wasps and bees cohabitate? And if so, what type of wasp is it that cohabitates with a bee?
Wasp and bees will not cohabitate. And here's the thing. There are solitary bees. There are bees that live in colonies. There are solitary wasps. There are wasps that live in colonies. And then there is an actual offshoot. There's almost like a bee wasp that we call a Spessa type of a wasp. And those are loners. The ones that are around the metal fences are probably going to be the solitary bees. And a lot of people don't adequately always knock the vegetation around the edge of the fences. And so that's where they're looking for their predators, their little caterpillars, their little beetle larvae that they can take and eat. And the bees and wasps world are quite unique. And then, of course, you have to throw the ants in top of that. But all ants are colonial. There's no solitary ants that I know of. And I've read extensively. There's a guy by the name of E.O. Wilson who is called the father of sociobiology and the world leading expert on ants. He's described over 418 new species, and as far as I know, he's never described a solitary ant. But the other key thing is that wasps are not hairy. Bees are hairy, and that's the biggest thing that I would look for if I was teaching a child the difference.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about in the insect world with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got a full lineup right now. Bill, you're up next, and then Catherine, John, and James, you'll follow in that order. Bill from Nacogdoches, so what's bugging you tonight?
Yeah, hi. I was on the phone earlier, and we were talking about, I think, millipedes.
Yeah.
And then I got I lost the connection. So you started to say something about that, and I missed it.
Yeah, very quickly. Millipedes are round. They do not have fangs, but they will emit a very smelly substance to the hands, so I wouldn't be picking them up. They're detritus feeders, so they're just returning organic material back into the nature, and so they're actually very good for the environment. Centipedes have fangs, they're flat, they're predators, so definitely do not mess with the centipedes. And of course, they are also a part of the ecosystem, but I wouldn't let be very careful with children around around centipedes. If you do want to spray to get rid of the millipedes, go with a regular pyrethrin. Anything ending that has an active ingredient that ends in THIRN, and Bill, you should be fine.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, and we have Catherine on line next from Alexandria. Catherine, what's bugging you tonight?
Hi, I was wondering if you could say something about using diatomaceous earth to control insects.
Mm-hmm.
I understand if you get the food grade kind, it's very safe. You can use it inside, not have to worry about your pets getting in it. Anything you could say about it, I'd appreciate.
Well, diatomaceous earth is a compost-like material that has very coarse ground-up calcium carbonate and silica particles to it. And a lot of people will line their flower beds with diatomaceous earth because all of your soft-bodied insects that would crawl across that, it's basically like crawling across razor wire or barbed wire, you know, across a prison fence, and it will scrape the underside of them and basically rip them up, especially things like slugs, snails, soft-bodied caterpillars. Although soft-bodied caterpillars don't really move that much, they pretty much stay on the plant that their mother deposited the egg on. Oftentimes people say that there are certain snakes that don't like to crawl across dichotomous earth crystals. As far as in-house use, I can't really imagine why you would want to use it in-house other than it just being an extra type of compost. But you're not going to have the same pests that would be targeted with dichotomous earth.
I thought they killed the hard-bodied insects too. Like roaches.
No, ma'am. With roaches, you don't even want to mess with dichotomous earth. What you want to put down is boric acid. It's very cheap. It's a nice powder. It's non-toxic to pest children. And you just want to spray it around the edges of the floorboards, the edges of the cabinets. They'll pick it up. It's like a irritant to them, and they'll clean it off their bodies. And then once those boric acid crystals hits the stomach of the cockroach, it literally causes lesions. It will blow holes in the gut of the cockroach. It won't kill them right away, but it will definitely kill them, and they will not be happy about it.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, our program about entomology and our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have James and Megan on hold right now. John from Fort Jessup, Louisiana, you are online next. What's bugging you tonight?
Oh, man, long-time listener, first-time caller. I have a question about cicada killers.
Lovely.
Are they solitary?
They are solitary, and they happen to be one of my favorite because they are so huge, and I can sit down with, you know, a cold drink, you know, a Coca-Cola or something, and just watch these things for hours. First of all, you'll see them in a grassy or a meadow-like area, and they will have this zigzag hunting pattern until they find a cicada, or as I talked about earlier, what we would call locusts here, those things up in the trees causing the big noise. Bill's got the sound cue for that. And they will take and they will paralyze them, but the paralyzation will not kill them. It will basically preserve them alive. And then if you watch them, they will have an underground nest that they will go to, And it's hilarious seeing these things carry them, because the cicadas are about as big as the wasp. It looks like a big B-52 trying to, you know, bring in another type of a cargo jet, and they'll land in there, and they'll pull and they'll shove that cicada in there. They'll lay an egg on the cicada, and then they'll tomb it up, and they'll seal that off as a cell. That egg will hatch, and that cicada larvae will literally feed on the living cicada until it dies, and then next year it'll emerge as an adult.
I guess my reason why I'm calling is I work down in Natchitoches, and there's this, you know, I do gardening down there, and these guys I work with like these huge wasps, and there's like 20, 30 of them.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed to be like a colony of them, and I thought, I saw one catch a bumblebee in midair.
Yeah, they're solitary, and the other great thing about them, John, is that they're non-aggressive. And so if you don't mess with them, they won't mess with you. But their ovipositor is about half a length of their body. So the last thing you want to do is get stung by one of these. So just leave them alone. Let them do their thing. Great part of the ecosystem. And believe you. And the reason you see so many at the same space is because obviously that's an optimal hunting ground. You know, you see, when it comes deer season, everybody wants the good spots, and so that's where they're hunting.
Oh, thanks. Hey, look, is your cohort a bird man?
Both birds and bugs.
I have to report two. I have to ask you. This winter in Natchitoches in February, I swear I saw a red spot. I have which is from what I looked in the, you know, the bird books, it's pretty unusual to be seen down here.
Well, I'll tell you what, because we've got some callers online. We want to get to them, but we are having a call-in show on Thursday the 12th called Bird Calls, and you can definitely call in during that with our expert at that time, and that's Dr. Cliff Shackelford, and he will fill you in on all those details if you'd like to call in at that time.
When is that date again?
That's Thursday, September 12th.
And Bill has it worked out so great. We've got those that have backbones and those that don't have backbones. If it's a squiggly, wiggly, creepy, crawly thing, I'm your gal. If it's got a backbone and wings, then call on the 12th and they'll be glad to answer your question.
Yes, indeedy. Right now, you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world. We have Megan and Marcia on hold right now. James from Colfax, you are online right now. What's bugging you tonight?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Burton, for taking my call. I have a guaranteed and tried and true method of getting rid of interior fleas that uses no pesticides. I've been using it for myself for about 35 years, and I have friends and neighbors that have used it and come back really raving about it. You take a pie pan, you put a little water in it, a couple of drops of Dawn or some type of surfactant, and then put a gooseneck lamp over the pie plate. The fleas jump up to the light bulb, fall in the water, the surfactant causes them to fall through the surface tension and drown. And you must do this for several nights in a row, and then once again, when the eggs hatch, about 10 days to 2 weeks later.
That does not surprise me that that works, because a lot of insects that feed on mammals are attracted to one of three of multiple things. One, a heat source, and only mammals are going to put out a heat source. They're attracted to CO2 that mammals are going to exhale. And then they're attracted to some sebaceous skin gland exudates that some mosquitoes can smell. A similar thing that you can do is take, and yellow works better than, if you can like find a yellow pie pan or a yellow frisbee and do the same thing, then that's going to attract a lot more of your wasp type varieties too. Sometimes I forget about these non-chemical things, but I would certainly not leave it in a single location. I would move it around, because fleas don't move that far from where they originate.
Right. Yes. You must move it around the room. So I would do it about every second night. You'll notice a decrease in the dead fleas in the bottom of the pan usually on the second night. So you move it to another area. And if you have a household infestations, you must do this room by room.
And still keep up the vacuuming, I would say. And then you've got a two-fold whammy against them.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You, our program about entomology and our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. A reminder again, on Thursday, September 12th at 6 o'clock, we will have our Bird Calls program with Cliff Shackelford, and he is our resident expert on ornithology coming up all the way from Texas, and he is with the Texas Wildlife and the Park Services there, and he will be here to answer your calls. If you have a photograph of any bug or any bird that you would like us to identify, you can send any of these to my address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu, and I will forward those on to the resident expert here at Red River Radio. Marcia, you are online next from Leesville. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Marcia.
Oh, this is Megan.
Oh, Megan, I'm sorry. I read the wrong name.
That's okay. So we have a little mystery on our hands. Recently, probably within the past 2 weeks, we've noticed some flies in our shower. We have a stall shower that's tiled.
Can I stop you right there?
Sure.
Are they small,
yes,
black, and
yes,
they look more moth-like than fly-like?
Yeah, they're like little hearts. They're little hearts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are called believe it or not, sewer flies. They're called forage flies is their more scientific name. That doesn't mean that your pipes are contaminated with sewer. That just means that this year, and most of the time, they are attracted to areas that will maintain and hold moisture. And so if I see them in my kitchen a lot, and you'll see them in your bathroom. Rarely will you see them anywhere else. Good thing is, they're a nuisance. They don't carry any pestilence. They don't carry any noxious type of microbes, bacteria, or viruses. Just pop them, and, too bad that they decided to live in your house.
Is there any way to get rid of them?
I just kill them and flush them down the sink.
Okay.
If there's a huge population, I would maybe run some soap water down the sink,
okay,
and clean the area good, perhaps with some chlorinated soap like Clorox, and that should take care of things until they might build up a little bit and then hit them again.
Okay, well, we've just got onesies and twosies, so hopefully just the soap water will work. But thank you very much.
Yeah, they're no harm.
All right.
Thanks.
Thanks for calling, Megan. And we're going to go next to Marcia from Jefferson, Texas. Marcia, you're online tonight. What's bugging you?
Yes, thank you. Well, here's the deal. My mother has wind chime on her front porch, which are cylinders. They're just metal cylinders. Recently, I was out there and looking around at that wind chime, and I noted there was a lot of grass debris hanging out of one of the cylinders. So I thought I'd clear it away, which I did, but I kept pulling, and it was just a whole gob of grass coming out, but it came out in a perfect little nest. So, and I just a few moments ago went out and looked at it again. Yes, there is a nest up in there, but I don't know what's there, and I didn't want to poke my finger up there to look. So would it be a spider?
It could possibly be a spider. More likely than not, it would probably be within the wasp family known as the mud daubers. Instead of using mud, they may be using mud that is heavily infested with grass spores that are germinating in there.
Huh.
And I would just take a, with all that soil up in there, you're not going to get the right resonance of the sound of your wind chimes. So I would just take a little hammer or a little dowel stick and clean it out and make mom happy, and they'll just have to go someplace else to live.
thank you. And I want to tell you one thing.
Yes, ma'am.
I collected locusts as a kid. The shells.
Yeah.
And I've got about 20 of them right now on my shelf. I've always loved them, and I give them to my little friends when I see them.
The exoskeletons are the ones that have exited out of the ground?
Right.
Yeah.
Skeletons, and I find them hanging on the fence, on the door, on the house, you know, everywhere.
Well,
around.
See, what they do is when they emerge out of the ground, insects are like little robots. What they're looking for is any type of a vertical surface. And yeah. Once they cue in on a vertical surface, they will crawl over there, crawl up the vertical surface, and then exit as an adult. And if you look in those little skins, they're actually called excuvae, you can actually see little thin lines, and that's their actual breathing tubes that was ripped and then replaced once they became adults. And so thanks a lot for your call, Megan, and I know there's a few other that Bill wants to get to.
We've got three more online. We've got Judy and Charles on the holding pattern right now. John from Crockett, Texas, you are online. What's bugging you tonight?
Yes.
Yeah, John?
Oh, John, I'm actually from Crossett, Arkansas.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Yeah. I read that wrong there. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, I got just two quick questions. I'll make it quick because I know there's other callers waiting. The first thing, we had birds a long time back in this house, like 2 or 3 years, and eventually we got what all I know to call them are little house moths, brown, very tiny, and very annoying. And we thought we got rid of them, but every season or so, I guess now, we somehow, like, you know, if we check our food cabinets and we see, like, a bag of, like, nuts one time or some bags that we thought were sealed another time, they somehow get in there. And I'm wondering, do you know a way without gassing the house that we could get rid of these domestic house moths?
Yes, I do, especially those that are found in the pantry. These are called Mediterranean meal moths, and they will get into flour, nuts, beans, anything that's a legume. What I do is whenever I bring anything like that to the house, I put it in the freezer for 3 weeks just in case it happens to be a minor infestation. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to go into that pantry and pull everything out, and you're going to find a hot source like pecans or beans or flour. Completely do away with that, and then you're going to have to put everything that's not infected into a thick container, like not a Ziploc bag. They can chew through Ziploc bags, but I'm talking about Rubbermaid Ziploc containers, and keep those in there until you no longer see. Take the boards out, clean behind the boards, because their little caterpillars will wander away when they get ready to pupate. There are, if you go through some Bugs Alive, you can actually get pheromone traps to monitor these in your pantry. And if you have any other questions about that, email me, beverly.burden@lsus.edu, and I can help you out with that in more detail.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio, your program about bugs and entomology. And we are going to go next to Judy from Kiachi. Judy, you're online. What's bugging you?
Yeah, Saturday night I was out on my front porch and I got stung by this little wasp-like insect that's about a half inch long, brownish black, and it felt like electricity went through my foot. It stung me twice, and I, no matter what I did, it hurt for a long time, and it's still swollen and looks like I don't know. It's like it's been still infected or something. But I couldn't imagine what kind of insect this small that would cause that much pain. I was wondering if you had any idea what it might be.
I'd have to see it. Brownish black, half an inch in length.
Yeah.
Would be not the first thing I would think of would be a soldier wasp, and they have a pretty bad sting to them. You might also be confusing these, and it's easy to do with them. With small varieties of horseflies, and they are a very painful bite.
Yeah.
But you would have to look at them very close underneath the microscope. If you happen to catch one, send it to me, Beverly Burden, Biology Department, LSUS report. It'll get to me, and I'll be glad to look at it and tell you what it is. However, in the meantime, what you need to do is to make sure that there, and I'm a PhD, not a MD, but to make sure that there's no secondary infection that sets in, treat it with Benadryl. It may sound like you may be hypersensitive to the a venom that they're injecting, and that would be my first concern for you. Identification is our second concern.
Right. It definitely is a wasp. It's a segmented creature, and I've got it in a little baggie, so it got down in my shoes, so that mystery unit stung me twice.
You made it mad. A lot of things aren't aggressive until it gets into a tight space, and then they'll become aggressive.
They'll do what anybody would do. All right, we have time for one, maybe two more callers, and we've got Charles online right now from Treeport. Charles, what's bugging you tonight?
Well, I had a question about cicadas.
Okay. What about them?
I've been listening in the mornings to the NPR, and they've been talking about insects and the world and the stuff. Now, I understand that they lay their eggs and they're in the ground for 17 years?
Some are 17 years, some are 13 years, and then we have our annual cicadas that are only 1 year.
Okay. When they lay their egg, where do they lay their egg? Because I understand that when they're developing and they're in the ground sucking the sap.
They are root feeders. Most of the time, root feeders on trees and shrubs. Sometimes they will attract turf roots like St. Augustine grass. And normally, unless it's a really, really, really high infestation, Charles, hardly anybody experiences any economic or aesthetic damage through the grub feeding, the immature feeding of cicadas. And so unless you think that the tree is starting to show signs of stress, I wouldn't worry about it.
All right. We've got time for one more call and a quick question. Brian from Alexandria, you're our final call tonight. What's bugging you?
I'd like to know the difference between mosquito hawks and dragonflies.
Excellent question. Mosquito hawks are actually flies. They only have two pairs of wings. They are not mosquitoes, nor are they hawks. And they are basically feeding on decaying material. They do not feed on mosquitoes, as popular myth would have it. They're completely harmless. Leave them alone. Dragonflies have four pairs of wings that are held horizontal. They have huge contiguous eyes. They do feed on mosquitoes. Their legs are actually shaped like little baskets, so as they fly through the air, it's almost like they have their own net sweeping it through the air, and then they just funnel the mosquitoes and all the other little flying insects up into their mouth. And the immatures of dragonflies are aquatic. The immatures of mosquito hawks are just living in moist, decayed organic material. Neither one of them are harmless. Good to have in the ecosystem. Great question.
All right. You've been listening to What's Bugging You. We appreciate everybody who has called in tonight. A reminder again, we will have another program of What's Bugging You in November, the date to be determined. And, of course, next month, September 12th, Thursday night at 6 p.m., we will have Cliff Shackelford on for another edition of Bird Calls here on Red River Radio. Stay tuned also for Health Matters, a regular monthly series here at Red River Radio. We'll have more information about the next Health Matters coming up on our website in just the next day or so. You have been listening to Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. We'd like to thank each of you for calling again tonight. What's Bugging You is produced by Bill Beckett and Renee Moran, assisted by Wally Derleth, Daniel Gordy, and Kermit Pauling. Dr. Beverly Burden is our expert entomologist, and I was your host tonight. My name is Bill Beckett. Stay tuned. We have Fresh Air coming up next here on Red River Radio, your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS.